Hello again, I'm Frieda Morrison. Welcome to Scots Language Radio and a programme that celebrates Athing to Dee with the Scots language. Fae Shetland to the borders and Athing in atween, we're there or thereabouts. In this edition, we hear about the work of the new Scots language coordinators in schools and another new project to appoint Scots language ambassadors in schools. Our special guest is internationally renowned piper, teacher and writer, senior lecturer at the School of Celtic and Scottish Studies, Dr. Gary West. And we pay fond tribute to our singer laureate, Jean Redpath. Again, it's a busy programme, so we'll nae hang aboot. This year, the Scottish Government, via Education Scotland, announced plans to appoint Scots language coordinators to schools all over Scotland. The coordinators have been appointed, and one of them is Dr. Simon Hall, who is based in Orkney. Simon, tell me more about the scheme.
In the springtime, Education Scotland appointed four of us, teachers mostly, to begin a two-year project working as Scots language coordinators with Education Scotland.
So how do you choose the schools? How are the schools approached?
Well, in the first instance, we go to the local authorities and we speak to the people there who have responsibility for language and literacy within the curriculum. And those people then will put us in touch with schools and with teachers who are interested in learning more about teaching Scots.
No, let's clarify, you haven't just started yet, you haven't been into schools yet, you're just putting up the plans to get into schools.
That's right, we've been in touch with the local authorities at the moment, and what we hope to do as time goes on is to start to provide a bit of in-service training, help to get teachers skilled up and teach them a little bit more about Scots so that they can pass that on in the classroom.
So you really need to train the teachers or teach the teachers, because you can't just go in and then disappear and leave them high and dry.
Well, there's a lot of great expertise out there and a lot of teachers in Scotland who are great Scots speakers and love to promote the language and teach it within the curriculum for excellence. At the same time, there are others who maybe don't know quite so much about it, and what we hope to do is to gather together all the good practice that's happening and to spread that around, to coordinate it, to put people in touch with one another so they can find out what good practice in Scots language education looks like, and hopefully we can see more of it happening.
So you're a secondary teacher. Now, what kind of subjects then would you include in a typical lesson? What would you be looking at in the end?
Well, I suppose the most natural place maybe for Scots is within English and literacy. And you would be studying texts that are in Scots. So you might be reading Scots texts. You might be listening to Scots texts, showing that you can understand them. You might be producing texts in Scots yourself, spoken texts. Or you might be writing in Scots. That's perhaps the most obvious place where we would see Scots in the curriculum. But there are lots of other opportunities for Scots as well across the curriculum. Particularly in areas like expressive arts and Scots song, especially, but also if you start to think about history or place names and these sorts of things, where there's a great deal of interest in Scots language in these areas as well.
Now, you mentioned their qualifications and you mentioned, you know, part of the school curriculum, but there's a new qualification in Scots just been introduced. Tell us a wee bit about that.
That's right. It's a very exciting development at the moment. The SQA, the Scottish Qualifications Authority, have just launched a new award in Scots language, which will be available for pupils at levels 3 through to 6. So you can study for this award, and part of it is about understanding and communicating using Scots, and the other part of it is about studying the history and the development of the language.
Okay, this is a difficult question, but that's not going to stop me asking it.
Sure.
As usual. But how would you measure success, or how would you identify success?
Mm-hmm. I think for us, success would be continued, sustainable teaching of Scots going on in Scottish schools after the end of our two-year project, to have a workforce of teachers in Scotland who are skilled up and able to deliver good quality Scots language education. We'd hope to see lots of primary schools teaching it. We'd hope to see a big uptake for the SQA awards in Scots language if we can help to get students signed up for that and get them through those awards. That would be wonderful.
Now, you mentioned the creative arts there as well in the past, and Simon, You've got a big event coming off at the Learning Festival. Tell us a wee bit about that.
Yes, we do. We've got a group of about 20 pupils coming from Stromness Academy in Orkney to the Scottish Learning Festival in Glasgow at the end of September. That's on Wednesday the 24th and Thursday the 25th of September at the SECC in Glasgow. And the Stromness Bairns are going to be singing a short set of Scots songs. Yes.
Which is going to be great, a fantastic.
We're all very excited about it, yeah.
Now, last but not least, tell us a little bit more. I keep asking you to tell us a little bit more, but you follow information. All these projects coming on, so my apologies. Yeah. You've set up, or you've put in motion, Sortidoot, the new Scots language ambassador scheme. Fits that to our boot.
Yes. What we're trying to do with the Scots language ambassador scheme is to invite confident Scots speakers or folk who write Scots or maybe use Scots in their careers, we hope, to form a partnership with a school where the ambassador will visit the school from time to time over a period of about 3 years. They'll come into the school and we hope they'll speak Scots when they're there, speak Scots to the staff and to the pupils, and we hope that they'll hear evidence of what the pupils have been learning, so that they'll hear good practice in Scots language in the schools. They might speak at a prize giving, or they might contribute to a school newsletter, or maybe just a little bit of online contact with the school in Scots, just to promote, again, Scots language education, and to raise the profile and the status of the language a wee bit in that slightly formalised school setting.
Now, you sent out the invitation. What reaction have you got?
We've had a great reaction so far. We've got lots and lots of people signed up to become Scots language ambassadors across a broad spectrum of different backgrounds as well. We've got singers and we've got writers and poets, as you might expect. We've a number of senior people from the world of education. We have actors, business people, all kinds of people.
All kinds of folk.
All kinds of folk.
But what are they?
Well, I can't tell you just yet because we haven't launched the scheme yet.
But if you tell us, we want to tell somebody else.
But it'll be on the radio and everybody will hear.
What
I do promise to do is when we launch the scheme in the end of November, I'll let you know then exactly who the people are, because we'd like to celebrate it and publicise it. And if schools or teachers are interested in having a Scots language ambassador for their own school to work with them, then they should contact me at Education Scotland. So that's simon.hall@educationscotland.gov.uk. Or they can contact my colleague, Katrina Lucas. That's Katrina with a K, katrina.lucas@educationscotland.gov.uk. And we'd be delighted to hear from schools or anybody working within local authorities who'd be interested in working with a Scots language ambassador.
Dr. Simon Hall-Fayor, can you tell us about the work of the new Scots language coordinators in schools and the ambassador scheme? And our best wishes to the choirs for Stromness at the Learning Festival in Glasgow. Great idea. Now, here's our first bit of music. It's for Cole Beg and their album Seeds to the Wind. Our studio guest Gary West, far you're about to meet, plays the pipes in this classic track. It'll mark you dance, so get a furl. This is the Mazurka set for Cole Beg. Thank you. wonderful, the mazurka set for Kohlberg's album Seeds to the Wind, a track I know and love so well. And on it you heard a fine piper, for happens to be your studio guest this edition. Welcome to the programme, Gary West.
Hello, Frieda. Now, good to be here.
Well, it's good to hear you. How long were you together as Kohlberg?
The band itself went for nearly 30 years, actually, because it was started in Dundee in the early 80s. And we had our final gig in the Queen's Hall when we decided to wrap it up in, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago or so. So it was a real long band in terms of its career, with one guy who was in it all the way through, which was Peter Boone, who sadly died just last year. Myself, I was in it for maybe 7 or 8 years in the first stint, and then went away and did something else, like got a real job, and then went back and had another 2 or 3 years after that. So great days. I haven't heard that for maybe 20 years actually, so apart from your own programme, of course, occasionally on the radio.
You just woke up and you're like, I heard that.
Well,
just
to explain that.
It was my signature tune for about 10 years when I did the Out of Doors programme with BBC Radio Scotland. I never scunned to it. It was just one of these tunes that you could add to anything. But it was a fantastic lineup, but it pushed back the boundaries, Kohlberg, didn't it? It tried different things, because that was, we're trying to work out far that comes from the mazurka set that was Galician. We think it's Galician.
Yeah, I mean, pipers like Galician music because it seems to fit really well under our fingers, you know, under our Highland fingers, as it were. But I suppose we pushed the boundaries a wee bit in some senses. Davy Steele was the singer, of course, through much of that period, and Davy had a great voice, and I think he was one of these, I know Steve here has worked with him as well, and he had one of these voices that was just so special, you instantly knew it was Davy. You know, it couldn't be anyone else, it was just him, and the instrumentals, Wendy Stewart, that you heard on harp there, very, very musical player, and great days. I miss these days, I have to say, and Davy and Peter are no longer with us, sadly.
We'll hear Davy singing a wee minty. Now, before we any further, let me fill in the bits. Well, the bits we can fill in. You are the husband of your better half, Wendy, a father to Charlie and Ailey. You are senior lecturer at the School of Celtic and Scottish Studies, the University of Edinburgh, renowned piper, teacher, writer, you hail for Pitlochry. You were a member of folk bands Kohlberg, Clan Alba, and a founder member of the Keighley band Hugh McDermott's Haircut.
Aye.
Okay, you performed in around 20 albums, solo album Isle of All, and another lovely album, as you mentioned there, harpist Wendy Stewart, called Hinterlands. Rift so far? In 2012, you published your first book called Voicing Scotland, Folk, Culture, Nation. Now, in this historic moment in Scotland's history, and in this programme that will cover the period when Scotland goes to the polls to vote yes or no for independence, I couldn't think of a better guest to have with us in the studio. And that's a good point to introduce my regular studio companion before he feels left out altogether. Folklorist Steve Byrne is here with us as well, course, is also a good person to have here. I've got to say that as well.
Half a kind.
And he adds to this very, very strong brew. Now, before we go into the pages of your book, these are looking to your ain roots and culture. When did the music start, and how were your influences musically growing up?
Aye, well, that's a good question, and I had to have a wee think about this when I was writing the book, because I wasn't very sure where it had all come from. But what I've decided now is that there were two main things when I was wee, when I was a bairn. There was the pipe band, local pipe band, Vale of Athol. But at that time, this would be in the mid-70s, it was a local community band. It hadn't yet made its mark in the musical scene. That was later. Just a parade band, went down the street, you know, twice a week for Highland Nights and things like that. And I was just fascinated by this thing, this sound and vision that marched down the street every week. And I barely remember it, but my grandfather took me down, and apparently I said to him, I want to do that. And sadly, it didn't live long enough for him to see me doing it, but I did it just a few years later. I joined the band, and I think that hooked me in terms of instrumental music and piping, that local pipe band. I was just fascinated by it. There wasn't any piping in my family at all, really. So, and then the other thing was songs and singing, and I had what I cried Ma Records. Now, my records were, I don't know what they were really. They weren't, I'm not old enough for them to be 78s, and they weren't LPs. I suppose they must have been EPs or singles, but they were in this kind of vinyl case that my mother had. And in fact, I think they belonged to an auntie before that. And it was Bothy ballads, Scott songs, Andy Stewart, people like that. I don't know exactly, I mean, they're long gone, so I can't check exactly who was on these albums. But every day I said to my mum, can I get my records on? And she would go away and put it on the turntable. And I would sit singing away and humming away. And it was, as I said, just, I suppose some stuff was more to the sort of music hall end of Scott song, but Bothy Ballads as well. And I just loved it. Callum Kennedy as well, a wee bit of Gala influence there as well. And I think these two things coming together, the piping and the singing, just set me up. And that's, I think, where it all came from.
Because he went to school with another renowned piper, Gordon Duncan.
Aye.
Mm. He was 2 years ahead of you, wasn't he?
He was, aye.
Growing up in Pitlochry, did you grow up in a Scots-speaking family?
Indirectly, I did, and if you count the family as being a bit wider than just the household, because my father was one of 12 bairns, and he was the second youngest. So the 12 spanned pretty well a whole generation between, I think there were some like 25 or 27 years between the oldest and the
wow.
youngest. And my granny must have been either pregnant or nursing for about 27 years of her life, which is, that would gar you great, wouldn't it?
Nippy.
So there was a distinct difference, and I remember noticing this quite young, between the way the older ones spoke and the younger ones of that family.
Ah.
So my father, he was too young, the horses had gone by that stage, they were farming folk, farm labouring folk. He took up a trade as a sparky, an electrician. We moved to Pitlochry, and it wasn't that rich, the Scots that was in the household itself, but when we visited all my aunties and uncles, who were, as I said, almost an entire generation older, they had this beautiful, this braw, earthy, lowland Scots, Perthshire Scots. They were real kind of nicht, bricht, thocht, focht, kind of, you know, and I was fascinated by this. And because my dad was a sparky, he was quite popular amongst the family for going to fix things. So we were always visiting folk. And I must have been taking this in, and I hadn't realised I was taking it until we, I remember in school, it was maybe primary seven, and interesting to hear that interview you just did earlier there about what's happening with Scots in schools. In my day, it was the Burns Federation stuff once a year. That was the main Scots thing. And I remember we got a test. It was like 25 questions about Scots words, Scots phrases, and so on. And I got full marks, and I didn't kent it somehow, you know. So it must have been staying in inside my head without actually realising.
Well, oh, you mentioned the farming in your family as well. Now, that leads me nicely into your Uncle Will.
Uncle Will,
a proud horseman. Tell us about your Uncle Will.
Well, Will was one of these older ones of the uncles. So again, well, he's not, he just died maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And he was a horseman, and he grew up, he was in Bothies from the age of 14 in Lowland Perthshire, all around Lowland Perthshire, and across into Steve's Angus as well, no doubt. The boundary wasn't a strict one as far as farms were concerned. And he was a horseman, and he went through the mill, as they said. He had the secrets of the horseman's word. He admitted to me that he had that, but he wouldn't tell me anything about it.
Because it's secret.
And he just loved working horses and hated the tractor. He said to me, you know, working horses, best job on earth, sitting on top of a tractor, even an old grey Fergie on a cold winter's day, the worst job on earth. And he soon got out of farming after the tractors came in. But he just loved horses, and he became a judge, and he was a ploughing champion and so on. But you know, listening to him speak, and I went and kind of interviewed him quite a lot when I was at university, because I thought, I've got to capture what Will's experience was. It just made sense that it wasn't just about the land, it was also about the people and the animals. It was bringing it all together, and that whole culture, that Bothy culture that was typified by the horses, was just, I don't know, it felt familiar to me, but just completely different from my life as well.
Now, you've got a quotation, an interview you did. What was the interview for?
Aye, well, this was actually, Will was kind of discovered by local radio in Perthshire, Heartland FM, and he became one of their sort of regular guests for a while. And so I managed to record one of the conversations he had, and I use this a lot, and I used it in the book because I just love it. He was basically being interviewed about just what I'm talking about, the old days working the horses, you know, through the 30s and 40s and so on. And so the interviewer said, did you break the horses yourselves? And Will said, I had my session at that as well, aye. So what, is this a year old colt? No, they were rising three, maybe rising four before they were broken. It didn't need to break them too young. They never got developed right, matured right if they were broken too young. And how'd you go about breaking a plough horse? God, I can't tell you that, man. I said, why not? I said, well, it's one of these things a horseman keeps to himself. And how did you learn it then if a horseman keeps it to himself? Because I was learning how to do it by older men. What kind of horses did you use? Clydesdales, mostly. Do you remember any of them by name? Them all? Everyone that I drove, I could tell you their name. Start at the beginning, let's hear them. Dick, Muss, Tink, Charlie, Dan, Sport, Jimmy, Nell, Jock, Prince, Punch, Chance, Charlie, Punch again, Tip, Nell again, Jock and Tam. You must have cared a lot about them to remember their names all this time. Oh, aye, I just loved them.
And I remember you telling me that story, and aye, I've never forgotten that he remembered every single name. Yeah,
and just like that, he didn't have to hesitate at all. You know, it was just straight out. And
the late Davy Steele based his epic song on that story. You gave the story to Davy Steele.
Aye, well, Davy had he'd left Kilbeg, and he went to the Kilbeg retirement home called the Battlefield Band, and Davy came round and said, "I'm needing some new songs," and I had just been working on this, not for the book, but for an earlier thing, and so I gave Davy a copy of the recordings and the transcripts, and next thing he turned up with this song, and it was doubly chuffed. Actually, I was teaching pipes out in America not that long ago, and someone sang this song, and I said, "Oh, my mate wrote that for my uncle." They didn't believe me, but it was true.
Tends to happen. It's kind of the last trip home, and here's Davy singing that song. Thanks, Gary.
Have I worked on ferns and frae and start, the muckle horses won my heart. We big broad backs they proudly stand, the uncrowned kings o'er the land. And yet for a' their power and strength, they're as gentle as a summer's wind. So steady, boys, walk on. Our work is nearly done. No more we'll till or plough the fields, the horse's day is gone. And this will be your last trip home, so steady, boys, walk on. Now you'll hear men sing their songs of praise, of Arab stallions in embrace, or hunters that fly away the hounds to chase the fox and run him down. But none of them compare, I vow, to a working pair that pulls a plough. So steady, boys, walk on. Your work is nearly done. No more mule till or plough the fields, the horse's day is gone. And this will be your last trip home, so steady, boys, walk on. And all the years I've plied my trade, and all the fields we've ploughed and laid, I never thought I'd see the time when a Clydesdale's work would ever end. But progress runs its driven course, and tractors have replaced the horse. So steady, boys, walk on. Our work is nearly done. No more we'll till or plough the fields, the horse's day is gone. And this will be your last trip home, so steady, boys, walk on. as we head back, our friends have lined the road to be there one last time. For none of them would want to miss the chance to see us pass like this. They'll say they saw in years to come the muckle horses' last trip home. So the steady boys walk on, your work is nearly done. No more we'll till or plough the fields, the horses' day is gone. And this will be your last trip home, so steady boys walk on. Your work is nearly done. No more we'll till or plough the fields, the horses' day is gone. And this will be your last trip home, so steady boys walk on.
Beautiful. The Last Trip Home, sung by the writer Davy Steele. You're listening to Scots Language Radio. This is Freda Morrison, with me as special guest Gary West and my regular companion Stevie Byrne. Gary, back to you again. We've got a picture of your early years in Pitlochry, but into the pages of your book, Voicing Scotland, published, as I said, 2012. Give us a brief description of what the book's about, Voicing Scotland, for folk that hasn't read it.
Very tempted to read the back cover because I can't really remember which is sitting in front of me. It's really about, I suppose I teach a lot about this in my day job as a lecturer, and I play it as a musician and listen to a lot of other people. So it was a kind of attempt to bring that together. And once I realised that actually I knew an awful lot of the folk that I was writing about, and that had been accidental. I hadn't started out, when I wrote to the publisher with an idea, I hadn't mentioned that, and it became a lot more sort of autobiographical, I suppose, than it was meant to be. But I quite like that about it now. I'm glad I went that way, because it meant that I could, I suppose, write from the heart, as opposed to just taking this sort of academic kind of sitting on the wall and looking at it objectively. And so it's really trying to say that traditional culture, as manifested through music and song and custom and so on, is as relevant today as it's ever been, perhaps even more so, because it's a journey, and in a, you know, increasingly globalising world, it's having those roots, but looking out from these roots and not being tethered by them, but using them as somewhere to look confidently outwards, is something that is a good thing, and that's really what it's about.
Just to be slightly controversial, and it's nae like
surely
me.
Not. It's nae surely
like
not.
Me. It's
surely
nae
not.
Like me. I kind of hear traditional arts or being or our heritage being mentioned a lot by only our politicians, for right or wrong. That seems to be focused on the making of money, which you think is something we're dinnicking about, making money. But there's nae a lot of money to be made in the traditional arts.
No.
Is there a link there? But going to my point, it's traditional arts are never being mentioned, cultures never being mentioned a lot in the political speeches.
No, I think that's true. And I was just actually having a wee look at my conclusion on my book last night, and there's one thing I'm very wrong about, which is I predicted, so that's a couple of years ago that I wrote this, I predicted that the debates about the referendum would come round sooner or later to the cultural aspect, because at that time it was still about economics. And I'm wrong about that, because it hasn't seemed to arrive in terms of these debates, you know, seeing them on the telly, that culture isn't really mentioned. However, at the grassroots level, the cultural elements in society in Scotland, if you like, are really driving the debate. I think that's been a real groundswell of folk who are cultural beings, whether they're musicians or actors or writers or what have you, who are really grabbing this by the horns and running with it, you know, on both sides to a certain extent. And so although the culture isn't really being debated at that level, at the kind of telly level, if you like, I think a lot of people who are culturally influenced and influential in themselves are actually doing a lot of the running of just getting engaged with the politics just now. So I think that's good. But I was wrong, because, you know, I was looking at other national other nations where they've gone through a similar process, and culture is usually historically right up there as one of the key things, and it hasn't been in Scotland. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. I've got some ideas, but I think it might be because there has been a real cultural flowering and renaissance anyway since the 1980s, I think. And there's a real confidence around about culture at the moment. And maybe some people are thinking, well, that's, you know, that box is already ticked. But as you say, there's not a lot of money around to support that.
Can I invite Steve Byrne to join us in the answer to this next question I'm going to pose? Otherwise, he'll get mumped and will feel he's being neglected completely.
Couldn't hear me being mumped.
Mumped. Nope.
I didn't even care what that means.
It wasn't a Persian word anyway. Yes.
There's nothing in the rules that says you can't make up words in this place. I think Mathering was interfering, guys.
That one's entered the lexicon now. So.
Yeah, right, here's my final question to you. What have we got new? And this a few days after the sad news that we've lost one of our finest ambassadors for Scottish culture, Jean Redpath, who was there at the start of the folk revival in Scotland. Where are we new? Now, folk music is now cool. Will our culture continue on the journey and communicate to the world with something important, or will it be diluted and into some sort of subject that has to go underneath change management? That dreadful phrase that you and I both love and hate. So Fitz, going to happen new? That's my question to you both.
Me first.
All right.
Who knows? Who knows what'll happen? But... Yeah, I mean, this cultural confidence thing that I've been talking about there, I think that's very real, actually. But I think the worst thing that could happen to traditional music, let's say, even just taking that, the traditional arts, I mean, the traditional arts is a phrase that we're tending to use for music, song, dance, storytelling. I suppose that's the main elements of the trad arts. I think the worst thing that could happen is that it just becomes a kind of useful marketing peg to hang things on. And you sometimes see elements of that and you think, I don't like that. You know, it's just another genre, another kind of cool thing that you get, trad is cool. But I think it goes much deeper and much wider than that in Scotland, and which is why I'm fairly confident it's not going to become that. Steve and I are both involved in TRACS, Traditional Arts and Culture Scotland, a new organisation that's just bringing together an umbrella of lots of like-minded people in the trad arts to try and give more of a voice, a collective voice, really, when it comes to things like funding and recognition and the politics of it all. And so I think it's going in the right direction. But, you know, who knows? Who knows where it's going to go? But I'm confident that there's a groundswell and a foundation there that will mean that it's healthy. Whatever happens, that it's healthy going forward. But Steve, I don't know if you're.
Before I allow Steve to speak, I was.
You're drawn out. He's not getting in
for a while yet. But I was really enthused at the fact that we had the Pumazafe Nyanga sing Hamish Henderson's song "Freedom Come All Ye" at the opening of the Commonwealth Games. I think that was a mark of something. That was a milestone. Right, Steve, getting your reaction now at long last. What do we got now?
I suppose just to pick up on your last remark there, I just thought, I mean, I'd kind of written this on one of my kind of social media status updates as well, that I thought that the song "Freedom Come All Ye" had kind of taken another step, if not maybe even the completion of its journey, since Hamish wrote it in 1960. You know, kind of the way that the world has moved on and society and all that kind of thing. I just thought it was absolutely fantastic, and I encourage folk to go and hear a look and a listen if they haven't seen it already. I agree with pretty much everything Gary says. Essentially, I think what we hate in terms of the kind of undercurrent and the anchor for other things that are going on in terms of the stage-based presentation of our traditional culture is we have other work that Gary and colleagues and you know, predecessors at the Skill and other places in Scotland have been doing in terms of the bedrock, the cultural bedrock that really contributes to the carrying stream, you know, the establishing of the archives and the digitisation, which we've spoken about in other programmes, and bringing this into folks' consciousness and gaining folk access to the material, I think, is a step change in the way that folk can actually engage with the culture. And I think for a wee while I was a bit worried, and myself about 3 or 4 years ago I had written about my concern at maybe some of the award ceremonies and the young folk coming through the university courses of just, well, we're missing a wee bit of context. You know, were they actually aware of the Jeannie Robertsons and the John Strachans? You know that we should be idolising these folk, but you should at least be aware of these folk have, you know, played a major part in establishing the validity of the culture, you know, brought to the fore by the likes of the Hamish and other colleagues at the school. And I just think, now that we've got that out there, that folk are able to go and look it up and engage for their bedrooms, you can just sit and listen. I think that's a right step for it.
You mentioned there the carrying stream, which is Hamish Henderson's metaphor for the folk that carry the tradition, which is a fantastic image in folks' minds. Like, long may it continue, long may the stream flow. And Gary's book, Voicing Scotland, is published by Lewis Press Limited, price £12.99. A snip, an absolute bargain. Voicing Scotland, published by Lewis Press Limited, price £12.99. Now, we have great pleasure, most days, there's other exceptions like, but it's a surprise and a pleasure to hear that my studio companion, Steve Byrne, has been raking about in books again. He rummels and he rakes and is never nae bother to naebody. It's happening round about this month. Well, Steve.
I'm not sure you can see me for books this month, Frieda, but... Well, there's a wheen of different things going on. I'll let you kind of put two or three things that's coming up in the month of September. At the National Library, there's a talk being given on translating into Scots. It's called From Virgil to Tintin. And it's a panel of scholars and translators, including Tom Hubbard, Derek McClure and Susan Rennie, who'd been the creator of the Scots version of Tintin. And that's happening on the 11th of September at the National Library at 6 p.m. There's also the Stirling Fringe kicks off on the 19th of September, 19th to the 28th, and they've got an event in the Scots tongue called The Flighting, and this is based around James IV and his court and the poets of the time, Dunbar and Kennedy. So that's taking place on the 21st of September at Argyle's Lodging in Stirling at 2 o'clock, so it'd be worth going along to hear the Scots language and for getting in a richt steer with that.
A richt fecht,
indeed. As if we've no heard enough of that the last wee whiley. Mm. But we had an interesting message come in to the Facebook page, Scots Language Radio, and it was for somebody that has another page on Facebook called Chuch Tunes. They've had requests for some reason or other to gang and translate modern songs into Scots. So see if you can tell me what song this is, right? I'll read you a bit.
Go for it.
Is this on real life? Is this just fantasy? Cop it in a landslide, nae escape fae reality. Open your een, keek up to the skies and see, I'm just a peer loon, nae need for bosies, cos I'm easy gang, easy gan.
It's Queen, Freddie Mercury.
Got to be.
That's bra.
And my favourite line is, Onny, why the soof blas? Disney really matter to me.
That is our motto. That's going to be put in our
motto. Onny, why the soof blas? So, and they've gone on and done all sorts
that
of things.
Excellent.
So we'll maybe get a wee collaboration with them later on in the year. Aye. If folk have songs they want translated, we'll maybe send them out to them for a laugh.
Something else?
Well, the 5th of September, 1750, was the birth of Robert Ferguson, you know, the poet's Aldrichie. So I was just going to read you a wee bit of his work. Of course, Ferguson's Aldrichie was a brilliant production put together by Billy Kay and some of the members of Jock Tamson's Bairns, a great LP that you can look up. But we were talking a bit about Scotland's music, and he wrote, as we've I been doing, you know, sounding the death knell of Scottish music for decades and centuries. And even in the 1700s, he was writing an elegy on the death of Scots music, which...
Catchy title.
Catchy title, aye. But I'm glad to say it's Arang. On Scotia's plains in days of yore, when lads and lasses tartan wore, saft music rang on ilka shore in hamely weed. But harmony is now no more, and music deed. A cheery fella, Robert Ferguson.
Cheery lad.
I'm glad to say you can, as we've spoken about, it's
alive and kicking.
Alive and kicking.
Something else?
The final thing. Well, we've talked about politics, so I've found a poem which is called Guy Likely, 1707. And now,
another catchy title,
Aye, this is for JMK, and I'll read this without prejudice. You can mark up your own mind, of course. It says here, a fragment. Sickest tramash. Sick of Durdham and Steer, raised in Pear Scotland that terrible year. The country was Connacht, Athengade Wrang. That was the end o'er auld sang. On ferm and craft the folk gaed daft, the peats grew clotty wheat and saft, the aits wi smuts they a' grew black, the deal a stack there was to thack. The barley wouldna yield its bree, a sair affair for you and me. And it gings on like that, so...
That's a cracker. Well, I say they're my favourite Scots word, connacht.
Aye.
I use it many a time. Many a time. See, thanks for that. And I'm going to be fair connacht as well by the time I climb up to the top of Benahee. I'm going to have the pleasure of joining up with the cast of a new Doric opera that's going to be performed outside on the slopes of Benahee near Inverurie in Aberdeenshire on the 5th and 6th of September. It's called the Maidenstone, a standing stone outside the village called the Chaplagiri, and the legend has it that a maiden was turned to stone by the deal. But in this opera, written by Joe Stollery, with words from Huntley poet Katrina Yule, there's a twist in the tale. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but there's a twist in the tale. Production includes pupils from 5 schools in the area under the watchful eye of the producer Maggie Hearn. Details: performance at 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. Price £5.50. Meet at the Benahee Centre. More information via the website. Here's the wobble use, so just concentrate on this. www.aberdeenperformingarts.com/events/ The Maidenstone. And you'll get information about clays, footwear, standing about and access and athing on that website. So I'm hoping to bring you snippets of that next episode. The text has to be said and sung in Doric. It's a first. I'll be cornered by the time I got up, as I said. Right, here's Gary West again with Wendy Stewart with a track for the Hinterlands album, The Gordon Cottage Set. Here it goes.
Thank you.
Gordon Cottage, of course, Gary, is where you wrote that tune for your parents, didn't you?
Yeah, it was for their golden wedding. Myself and my brother, who's a drummer, kind of put our heads together and came up with that. It was our present to mum and dad. So Gordon Cottage is the house in Portlochry that I grew up in, that they still live in. Aye.
Lovely. You're listening to Scots Language Radio. This is Freda Morrison with me, special guest Gary West, and my regular companion Steve Byrne. Now, a few days ago, on the 21st of August, we got the sad news that Jean Redpath had died in a hospice in Arizona. She was considered one of the finest Scots singers to emerge in the early British folk revival, and to many was Scotland's singer laureate. She was revered as a Scottish musical treasure with an immense understanding of traditional music and the great ballads. She made more than 50 records, including 7 LPs of Robbie Burns songs over 20 years, working with a renowned American composer called Serge Hovey, who devoted most of his working life to the study of Burns songs. They set out to record all the 323 Burns songs and made it to 180, and they still stand as the definitive. This is Jean singing A Fond Kiss.
A fond kiss, and then we sever. A farewell, and then forever. Deep in heart, wrong tears I'll pledge thee. Warring sighs and groans I'll wage. What shall say that fortune grieves him, while the star of hope she leaves him? Me, nae cheerful twinkle lights me, dark despair fancy. Nothing could resist mine ansy, but to see her was to love her, love but her, and love forever. Had we never blindly, never met and never parted, we had ne'er been broken hearted. Fear thee will thou first and fairest, fear thee best and dearest, thine be elke joy and treasure, peace, enjoyment, love and pleasure. A fond kiss, and then we say,
Jean Redpath singing A Fond Kiss. Jean was born in Edinburgh, grew up in Fife in the early 60s, made her way to the new burgeoning music scene in the States and eventually the epicentre of the American folk revival, Greenwich Village, where she shared an apartment with Bob Dylan. And many Americans became familiar with her songs and singing through her frequent appearances on Garrison Keillor's popular public radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. In 1979, she took up residency as a lecturer at the University of Stirling, as well as performing around the world. She was a true champion of Scottish culture, and to many of us who had the privilege of working with her, she was an inspiration and a mentor who encouraged and supported. And Steve, you worked with Jean and to an extended way, looking into the some of the recordings of Jean for the Crystal Riches, didn't you?
That's right. Aye, as folk maybe kens, I was a cataloguer for the project on Scots Sang. And Hamish Henderson, of course, has been mentioned in a number of the obituaries as being one of Jean's mentors, and certainly he kent Jean from the early days, really, when she was beginning to get to the States in the early 1960s. And there's a great collection of recordings from 1960 where she's, what, about 23 year old, and at that time is kind of really exploring her own sang culture, having gone to university to study something else, tripped over the sort of folk song society that Hamish had started up in 1958, and basically realised she had a load of these songs in her family as well, alongside the things she was being played at lectures and meetings of the club, you know, mm-hmm. big singers like Jeannie Robertson, finding out that her mother had a store of songs. So she's getting through the process there. It's an evolution you can hear on the tapes of her.
Have you got a tape for us to listen to?
Well, this is a later tape, really, of her reflecting on her meetings with Hamish. She's speaking in 1985 to Stephanie Smith-Perrin about that first meeting with Hamish Henderson.
Consciously, probably not longer than that first Edinburgh University Literary Society meeting that Hamish did and came along with his tape recorder and tapes of Jeannie, that would make me somewhere around maybe 19. The only reason I'm saying I couldn't take it any further back than that, I learned a lot of songs earlier than that, but I had never had any reason at all to stop and wonder whether they were traditional, whether I was learning them by oral transmission, whether in fact I had ever consciously learned them or not up until that point, and having heard Hamish do his pitch, you know, his soft sell, I suddenly was conscious that a lot of the stuff that I was listening to I already knew in one form or another. And I think I may have told you at one point, I never quite forgave him. He could have killed a lifelong interest stone dead on the spot if I had been a little less excited and a little more sensitive, because I raced up to him and said, that song that, you know, the woman sang about the Overgate, I know another version of that, and sang him one that my mother knows. And his comment was something along the lines of, very interesting variant, yes. And I thought, variant, nothing. You know, this was a discovery of a lifetime for me. And here's him and his academic variant. So I've pulled his leg about that ever since. That's probably when I first rubbed shoulders with traditional music by that name. And I've been up to my knees in it ever since.
Up to our knees in traditional music. Great, that. And I love this quote, Steve, from the New York Times, saying her slightly smoky timbre keeps her singing from becoming too sweet.
Aye,
that was
right.
Important, wasn't it?
Indeed, and she's
got that grittiness.
Aye, and she had that from an early age, if you can back, and you can hear the recordings on the Kista Rich's website, that she was, even at the age of, you know, 23, she was singing ballads like, you know, with a kind of an older voice, you could almost say, you know, completely different to her speaking voice. It's amazing listening to some of them recordings, the way she's absorbed things.
Another quote that I picked up as well just recently is, Jean didn't like the term folk singer. So I'm going to try and avoid using that. And as the Edinburgh Daily News puts it, describing Jean Redpath as a folk singer would be like describing Michelangelo as an interior decorator.
Indeed.
Now, in 2011, she returned to Edinburgh University to take up a post as artist in residence at the School of Celtic and Scottish Studies, where all those years ago, as you just heard, Hamish Henderson had introduced her to the music and song of the archives and set her on a very unique journey, albeit in a wee bit of a sort of detour with the variant quote. I love that quote. Jean was working in the same department as our studio guest, Gary West. Gary, put this in context. What's Jean's contribution to Scottish culture?
Well, it's immense, isn't it? And it was great to get her as the artist in residence, a job you know very well yourself, having taken over after her, I think,
that's
wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
So the idea there is to get artists who have an academic interest as well into the department, working with the archives, working with the students, just trying to get them to see things from their own different perspectives and, you know, try and open their ears as well as their eyes, really. So getting Jean over, obviously practically it was quite tricky with her living most of the time in the States, but she came over quite a lot and did some concerts for her and so on. So, you know, as someone who grew up listening to her, it was fantastic just to have her there in the department, ask her about these days when she was working with Dylan or living with Dylan and sharing a flat
Absolutely.
With Dylan, and just amazing stuff. And she was the Scottish voice over there of the folk revival. She was the Scottish representative, you know. But her legacy, I suppose, just hearing her voice there when she was singing, we mentioned Jeanie Robertson, and it reminded me quite a bit of Jeanie, that almost operatic quality to her voice. Right. She could have been if she'd wanted to be, same with Jeanie, you know, an opera singer, mm-hmm. I'm sure, and but without the vibrato, you know, without that kind of classical Italian
grittiness
sort of,
there.
There was a grittiness and just pure, and but, you know, sang with so much feeling, so much earthiness, so much understanding of where it all came from. And I think mm-hmm. that's of course that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's not just singing the notes, it's mm-hmm. it's singing the tradition that lies behind the notes.
I worked with in quite a few programmes when I was up in BBC in Aberdeen, but I actually remember the first time I heard her singing in Aberdeen. I remember the song she sang, you know, all those many years ago. It's what the impact that she marks on folk. And one of my favourite memories of her is we were piling into, I think it was Reinekirk in Aberdeenshire. Now, Reinekirk's a lovely little kirk in the village. The whole community was in this kirk to hear Alistair Fraser and Natalie Haas play. Alistair Fraser, the fiddle player and the cellist. And down in the front pew, we didn't care about it, but down in the front pew, Jean Redpath was sitting there. And Alistair went into Aphon Kiss Burns' tune, the other tune that mm-hmm. they sung to that thing. And he nodded to Jean to start singing. He said, invited her in a nod, and she shook her head, no. And she was sitting with her elbow up in the back of the pew, relaxing in the front pew, just enjoying the music. And he kept playing, and then he nodded to her again, and she smiled, and still with her elbow in the back pew, she sang Aphon Kiss. Now that voice, folks, mm-hmm. rose to the very top of that kirk, rafters. Mm-hmm. And there was bairns in there, there was Iages in there, we were hanging over the pews, up in the big gantry, the high up seats. And he could have heard a pin drop. And I'll never, ever forget that moment that we heard that voice soar. Can you speak about voices soar? That voice soared. Wow. And you can imagine the impact it does with Alistair Bakken and Natalie Haas in the cello. What a wonderful moment, you know. Fond memories of Jean Redpath, the most influential singer and ambassador for Scotland song over 50 years. So we finished this programme with Violet Jacob's poem, set to music by Jim Reid, The Wild Geese or The Norland Winds, and the wonderful voice of Jean Redpath.
Oh, tell me what was on your road, your own Norland wind, as ye come blowing fae the land that's never fae my mind. My feet they travel England, but I'm deep. A man I heard the cellar tides run up the firth afore. I wind again the wheel enough and finally fall and rise, and fain I'd feel the creeping nest on yonder shore that lies. But tell me ere ye pass them by, what saw ye on the way? My man a rocked a roving gulls that sail up in the tea. But saw ye nothing lee and wind before ye came to Fife? There's muckle lying yon the tea that's mair to me nor life. My man a swept the Angus brae. Far up
child is free.